when the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain, and you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Hi, I'm Mark Laren Young, and thanks for tuning in to the Tai and the Green Chain podcast. Today we're linking up with John Valiant, author of the award-winning and unforgettable book, The Golden Spruce, A True Story of Myth, Madness, and Greed. The Golden Spruce was a 300-year-old Sitka that was a scientific miracle and a spiritual one. An albino tree with golden needles, it should never have existed and never have survived. And in 1997, a logger cut it down. John's book tells the story of the tree and the man who cut it, but it also tells the story of the forests and the way trees have been chopped for generations. John's also going to tell us about his next great adventure, a trip he's taking right now for National Geographic to share the story of a unique and inspirational forest in the Canadian Rockies.
I've got to know, how did a travel story on kayaking turn into a book about a mythic tree?
Completely accidentally. I'd been called to the islands just by its location, hanging there off the coast and looking so kind of mysterious and inviting, but I really didn't know what was up there beyond, historic totem poles. And I had this out-of-date tourist map that had, various sites to see and things to look at, and one of these was a golden spruce, and I thought, that sounds really bizarre. And when I was done my kayaking story down in Guayhanas, I had some time to kill, basically, and rented a car up on Graham Island and was driving around and was looking for this tree. And, that maze of logging roads up there that kind of spiders out, like varicose veins really across that beautiful island. And I was lost in those and found somebody who looked like they knew where they were more so than I did, and asked them, where is this tree? And he said, you can't see that anymore. And what do you mean? Well, it's been cut down. And I knew, I knew it was protected, I knew it was special in some way. And I said, who would do a thing like that? And he said, a logger did it. But he did it as an act of protest, against what? Against logging. And so I'm, scratching my head, probably as much as the listeners might be. And, what happened to him? And they said, he disappeared in a kayak. Nobody knows where he is. And I just filed that away. There was a story. It wasn't the story I was there to write. I was completely blindsided by it. And the guy was so mad because it had been 3 years, since the tree was cut down when I first showed up there in 2000. And so this guy had digested it. He wasn't angry anymore, or it wasn't news to him anymore. And so his matter-of-factness and the strangeness of it, that combination really just lodged in my mind. And when I got home, I just started scratching away at archived newspaper articles from that event. And everything I learned just raised more questions. It basically got stranger and stranger.
What was it that caught you most? Was it the story of the spruce? Was it the story of the logger, Grant Hadwin? Where did it catch you?
It's that combination of things, of this extraordinary tree that really shouldn't have existed, that was almost a botanical impossibility.
Can you explain that? Because I was going to try and explain it in the intro, and I thought, I bet you can nail down.
It's pretty neat, basically, chlorophyll is what makes trees green, and chlorophyll is what makes photosynthesis possible, and photosynthesis is what makes it possible for all the green things on earth to live. This tree had lost most of its chlorophyll. It had been burned out. It had a genetic defect that caused the chlorophyll to break down under ultraviolet rays. So basically you have this gigantic tree that needs chlorophyll to grow, but there is no chlorophyll there except underneath. It's got maybe 50% of a normal tree's allotment of chlorophyll. So it'd be like you or me trying to compete against successful huge, powerful athletes, say in a marathon or in a football game, with one lung or half a heart or something like that. I mean, imagine being debilitated to that degree and then kind of transpose that onto a tree, and you would think, well, this tree would be a dwarf. It would be some stunted version of itself, or it would die very early because nature is quite ruthless with genetic defects. And instead, this tree thrived. It was as big as the other trees. It was an appropriate size for its age of 300 years, and it was absolutely healthy appearing, even though it was growing strangely. It was deformed in terms of its shape as a Sitka spruce. It had these bizarre, you know, pigments, and it was apparently sterile. It produced cones, but none of the seeds were viable in the cones. And so you've got this tree with these three massive defects, massive in terms of, you know, what makes the natural world go round. And yet there it was, standing there, bigger than life. And then you have, on top of that, this spiritual narrative significance to the Haida, this social environmental significance to the Anglo logging population of that place, for whom it was kind of a mascot. And then you have the scientific puzzle behind it. And then you have this guy. And what I think really made me pursue the story was that here was this man who did this kind of wacky, angry thing and was written off by the press as a, you know, as a vagrant, you know, no address, no job, you know, some kind of burnout loser. And yet, you go back a little bit in time and you find out that this guy was practically a star in his field. And talking to these guys who supervised him, who are, you know, very hardcore dyed-in-the-wool loggers, you know, very, very mainstream. And they're saying, this guy was amazing. You know, what this guy could do both physically and also intellectually in the field was above and beyond what anyone else really could accomplish. And so here was this guy who was incredibly good at what he did, who had totally paid his dues in the forest, who had this incredible change of heart that made him do this absolutely radical and tragic thing that ultimately destroyed him and the tree.
Okay, one of the things that fascinated me when I saw this in the New Yorker was I was aware of the golden spruce being cut when it happened. I still had the newspaper clippings in my files of amazing BC stories. And yet, no one had taken this on. And I thought it was fascinating that here you weren't from BC, you saw this and you went, yeah, this is special. What do you think you saw that everyone else missed?
Well, I had an advantage being a stranger to this place in that I was absolutely astounded by the enormity of the trees, by the intensity of logging, by the intensity and sheer enormity of the landscape. And locals are used to that. They've incorporated, they've adjusted to the size. You know, I'm coming from little tiny New England states, you know, that you can drive across all of New England in a day. And, you know, my first trip through BC took 16 hours, and I thought, wow, I've seen some of the province. And I'd just gotten to Lillooet. And when I went back and looked at the map, you know, I had to take a deep breath. I'm not kidding. My whole psychic molecular concept of what nature and space is was completely disrupted by moving here. It's a whole different scale. And so I was already kind of in awe of this place. And then here was this bizarre tree and this strange man. And the other thing that I had, I think, going for me was that I didn't have any kind of deadline. Newspaper journalists, you know, have a terribly difficult job, and they, you know, they need it yesterday or at the very latest tomorrow. And it took me 6 months of freelance scraping and digging and calling and pestering just to find out where Grant Hadwin had grown up. It took 6 months to find that out. And, you know, so who has that kind of time? And also there was something about him, though, that resonated for me. And a lot of people, I think it's almost, he was so close, you know, it, just to think about it made people angry. You know, he took something beautiful away. He did a terrible thing. And why do you want to go and honor a guy like that with curiosity? You know, and I think that really came through in the newspaper articles. And, you know, again, being from outside, I didn't have the same stake. I didn't feel violated the same way that local people felt. And I think, in some ways more open and probably more familiar with psychological complexity than maybe the average journalist is. So,
well, what fascinated me about the book was that, in addition to telling me what I didn't know about the Spruce and telling me who Grant Haplin was, it is probably the best history of BC logging in terms of how it all works, how our forests are cut, how our forests are managed. And again, you saw it with a very different eye than I think a local would. How did you decide you were going to get into logging, the history of logging and the history of BC forestry when you set up to turn this into a book?
There was no way to tell it. I realized that to make something as large as a book, you kind of have to pull back. Hadwin and the Tree was enough for a 7,000-word article, but Hadwin and the Tree couldn't support a whole book. So I felt you just kind of keep pulling back and pulling back and pulling back until you have a story that's the size of a book. And that story included a history of British Columbia, a history of logging in this province. And also what I was trying to do, though, in writing this book was pull back so that I could actually kind of metaphorically see the curvature of the earth, so that we could see how we got to this point. That the Golden Spruce and Grant Hadwin are two organic but very bizarre outgrowths of this province and its history. And how did we get to this place? Because BC, in a way, is a culmination. You know, it started back in Europe, it started back in the Middle East, it's this progression. And you can't look at BC, you can't look at any place in isolation. And, you know, Hadwin came from the British Isles, you know, the botany and history of this tree is, you know, thousands, millennia, hundreds of millennia old. And I wanted people to understand how we got here. Also, I wanted to understand how we got here.
What were some of the bigger surprises for you looking into the history? Was it the characters like Gordon Gibson? Was it how the forests had been run over the years? What hit you?
Well, I was really, you know, coming from a kind of lefty, enviro-urban background. You know, I'm, you know, the logging industries, you know, I was coming from a very simplistic point of view of, you know, trees are good and logging is bad. And I knew that that was simplistic. And I at least had that, I was aware enough of myself to realize that my point of view seriously limits my understanding of these issues. And so I really wanted to go and get into the other mindset, you know, the mindset of the height of the mindset of a forest, insofar as it has a mindset, the mindset of the logging industry, and see where they were coming from. And also coming from a pastoral place like New England, it's all been cut down, you know, and you know, you call them clear cuts here, and back there we call them fields, but they're the same thing. It's a clear cut that's been, you know, planted with something or other. And clear cuts and wide open spaces are normal to me. And when I first got out here, I still feel often totally oppressed by the forest. My impulse is, I need some light. How am I going to get that light? I got to cut some space for myself. And that's, you know, I feel that deep inside. And that is the way Europeans think. And I'm a European. You know, I happen to be from the eastern edge of North America, but I've got a European sensibility, which is, you know, it's all been cut down before. I never saw those big forests. And I was really interested in that impulse to come and make it look like something that we know. And all the people that came here and logged this place, they all came from the East, virtually all of them. All of them came from places that had been clear cut hundreds, if not many hundreds of years prior. And so they were recreating their own world. And also that I was really fascinated by this sense that these forests were worthless and lifeless. And obviously they're anything but. And we're just beginning to understand that now, really, in the late 20th, early 21st century. But up until this point, so many people, they were described as environmental deserts, ecological deserts. The wood was described as, you know, as useless. And just these, they were just these enormous, you know, 100,000, you know, 1,000-ton obstacles to progress, and they had to be removed. And that's, I knew those were my origins too, and so I had to challenge them and explore them and try to understand them. And I think, you know, readers can relate to that.
Looking at that history of BC, what surprised you most?
One thing, how efficient people have been in rearranging this landscape. You know, when you look at how absolutely enormous this landscape is and how much of it has been logged, it's, you look at how effective human beings are for good and ill, and it's, in this case, it's very sobering. And the other is just the incredible wealth of life and really what a kind environment this is in so many ways, in terms of the tremendous bounty that the sea provides, the tremendous bounty that the trees provide in terms of being very easy to work, Douglas fir and cedar both. What a beautiful, perfect place to live. And, you know, we're in the process of turning it into something else right now. But, you know, historically, it's, you know, when you look at the, you know, the history of this place, say, 500 years ago, it was just a very violent place to live, you know, socially. But what bounty, what an embarrassment of riches is here. And you know, New England was tougher. You know, a lot of places are much tougher to live. The deserts, mountains, you know, but there's such that the combination of the temperate and just the unbelievable bounty of food and resources.
Looking at the history of logging in this province, what do you think we've learned from it?
I don't know. Really depend on who you ask. I don't know if we've learned anything. You know, it seems to be business as usual out there. And, you know, a few pockets have been saved at enormous cost. You know, I think human beings have enormous difficulty with balance. And there's also this attitude that you really see here, that nature is like a sucker to be taken advantage of. And you can just go in and rob that cookie jar anytime you want. And this notion of seeing nature as a business partner, I think that's our only way out, you know, as a partner in our future. And right now, I think a lot of people have trouble seeing it that way. And so there's still that legacy of contempt, really, of that, you know, I can just take this. It's mine. It belongs to us. We bought it. We leased it. That's what it's here for, whatever it is. And I think underneath that, there's a kind of contempt and disrespect. And I don't think it's even conscious, but it's an old, old attitude, hundreds and hundreds of years old. And, you know, it's laid waste to enormous tracts of this planet.
Well, I heard the other day about an environmental philosopher or a philosopher incorporating environmentalism saying that we've got to rewrite the social contract so it's no longer just man and man, it's man, man, and nature.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I mean, you know, I there are a lot of people who are stressing that in different ways. And, I was trying to think, how do you articulate this, you know, to an Exxon or to a Monsanto or somebody like that? And that's why I sort of came up with the idea of a business partner. It's, you know, because if you screw your business partner, that is going to have repercussions for you in the future. Either you're going to be closed out of markets or you're going to get a bad reputation or whatever. And if you show respect to this place that gives us so much, and, you know, it's just astounding, you know, it's the sine qua non of everything. And yet we have this ability to objectify it in this way that, even if it's not intentionally so, has hostile effects.
When did you decide to move here? Was that before or after this story?
Oh, before. No, it was, moving here was a total experiment. 98, and my wife, Nora, got into graduate school here at UBC, and we thought, whoa, you know, 2 years, what a great opportunity to experience a place we've heard lots about. We were here for 2 days in 1993, and, spent all our time in the Royal Museum in Victoria and in the Anthropology Museum, and out at UBC, and just that idea of public storage, where the whole collection was open to the public, and I thought, you know, that's civilization. Rather than having 99% of it hidden away in a basement and only PhDs can go look at it, if you go to UBC, you can see, you can look at, you know, all the spoons and all the argillite and all the baskets, and anybody can do that. And that's how, you know, that it's a tiny little example, but it's a big difference.
I actually didn't realize that was unique because that's what I grew up with.
Yeah, well,
I just thought that was how museums worked.
Yeah, it's not how they work. Okay. I'm here to tell you. And so when we saw one that worked that way, I just thought this is very evolved and forward thinking and generous with knowledge, you know, as a museum should be.
Cool. Now, can you tell me about the National Geographic story you're off to do? Because that sounds like another amazing BC forest story that isn't told enough.
Yeah, it's the Musco-Kachika is an enormous segment of the Northern Rockies, kind of bracketed around sort of between Fort Ware and Fort Nelson. It's 25,000 square miles. It's about the size of Scotland or the state of Maine. It's reputed to have 50 pristine watersheds in it. All the species that lived there, you know, 300 or 400 years ago, to my knowledge, are still there and thriving. And a fellow named Wayne Sawchuk and another guy named George Smith and some other concerned citizens up there realized that in order to maintain the integrity of this place, they needed to build a consensus of behavior and a kind of guidelines for how to act in there. And they engaged people from the oil and gas industry, people from the timber industry, big game hunters, First Nations, environmentalists, local land use planners, and said, okay, you know, can we agree that this is a place that we need to keep intact? And people said, yeah. And okay, how are you going to get oil and gas out of it without destroying it? How are you going to hunt grizzly bears in it? And it was too big just to close down and say, no one's allowed in here. And Wayne Sawchuk himself is a trapper. He's a former logger. And this is, and he had an awakening. You know, Grant Hadwin had an awakening too, and it took a much more tragic and destructive turn. This guy has seen the writing on the wall. It's all over BC. And has said, okay, you know, that's going to happen here unless we act proactively and engage all the stakeholders. And it's been in existence for 10 years. There has been some exploration, but it's been very, very sensitively done. And it's such an enormous area that it presents a model in microcosm for how to manage ourselves, even on a provincial scale, on a national scale, potentially even on a global scale. And the fact that these guys have been able to keep this conversation going without anybody blowing out or disregarding them and just kind of storming in there and, you know, logging a couple of alleys because they can. That hasn't happened, to my knowledge. And so what's strange is that nobody knows about this place. And I ask many British Columbians who are environmentally literate, who read the newspaper, who are well-traveled, they don't know where this place is. I'd never heard of it until I met Wayne Sawchuk, who was one of the kind of founding fathers of the idea at Banff last November. And when he told me what he was up to, I was just amazed. And I said, you know, the world needs to know about this vision and this way, this alternate way of engaging stakeholders that isn't acrimonious, that isn't defensive, that isn't fearful. And that's what I'm going to explore and write about.
Sounds like a very cool story.
I'm incredibly excited, yeah.
And I've got a couple of questions that I'm throwing at everyone who does this with me. How do you feel about trees?
Pretty awe-inspired, really. You know, I just look at those things and that they are able to make so much from so little. all these invisible things, air and sun and tiny minerals and water, and to manifest such gravitas and such generosity and such beauty out of that. And it's, what a model. What a model for how to be in the world.
And if somebody turned around tomorrow, gave you a magic wand or a magic piece of golden spruce, what would you do with our forests?
I would be overwhelmed by that responsibility, and I would want to, I think what I would do, I would call a moratorium to cutting old growth right off the bat, and I would say I would put a lot more time, money, and resources into understanding the systems that function underneath and within our forests. You know, I think they're just seen as fiber farms, and it's a much more complex, you know, we're seeing it, you know, if you look at the bug kill in the interior, we're messing around with stuff and we're reacting to things that we don't understand terribly well. And I think we all owe it to ourselves to spend a lot more time trying to understand it. And, but I don't have, you know, a quick, magical, clean answer. I, you know, one of the things I learned from the little I know about this is that it's enormously complex, and a lot of it is dependent on region and species and terrain and all kinds of things. But I think one of the things I would want to do is, you know, yeah, not export raw logs, this is the thing. This is how, if you look at a fir beam or a Sitka spruce beam now, the only people who can afford things like that are millionaires. They're luxury items now. They're status symbols. You know, beautiful, clear pieces of wood. And I think that's healthy in a way. I think we should treat these as precious, beautiful, extraordinarily valuable objects. And the forests that create them should be revered and respected accordingly. And, you know, we finally got to that point, but partly it's because there's so relatively little of it left. You know, even though, you know, you can look at reports from 1919 and people were saying, this stuff, we are logging this stuff faster than we can replant it. And we're not going to see this stuff again for 800 years, if ever. And, you know, so people have known this for a long time. And it's so tied to our appetites and our sense of what we're entitled to. And, you know, I almost sort of want to, you know, take the logging industry and sort of do this massive workshop where people explore their sense of, you know, what they have a right to, what they think they should have, how they see the forest facilitating their dreams and their lifestyles. You know, like, how many acres of forest is a speedboat worth, or a jet ski, or a mortgage, or a college education? You know, and is that the most efficient way to use a forest? And these are questions I don't really see anybody asking. So, you know, I don't have a clean answer. There's a really messy, rambling response. But the other thing is, you would be surprised if you speak to a logger or someone in that industry who's not been pushed into a defensive position, how deep their understanding is of what they do and how how well they understand the costs of their actions, and yet they're caught in it. You know, we all are. You know, we're all the way we're tied to oil, they're tied to logs. You know, none of us wants to give up our car. You know, and a logger would be an idiot to give up making $600-$800 bucks a day, you know, to finance his dreams, whatever they may be. So,
I think the first time I interviewed a logger, he said that he was the real environmentalist because he had to make his living off this land. Remember hearing that from loggers and from trappers?
Yeah.
I said, no, we're environmentalists.
Yeah. Yeah. very, very complicated. And that's the thing about the Musco Pachica is you've got people who are all invited to the table. It's not that, you know, you have to fight for your right to be here, or you don't have a right to be here, or we're trying to keep you out of here. It's saying, it's assuming that all these needs are valid, and then going from there. And, you know, I don't see how we're going to get out of this without doing that.
That's very exciting. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
The Golden Spruce, a true story of myth, madness, and greed, is available in paperback from Vintage Canada. And stay tuned to find out when John Valiant's new story turns up in National Geographic. For the Green Chain Podcast, I'm Mark Laren-Young.